Delivering growth in a world of austerity and localism, it seems to me the exam questions this summer, half of them ought to be about the relationship between austerity and localism. Which causes the other and which prevents the other. We're going to learn about this in the Cambridge context. Alex is the chief executive of Cambridge Horizons, which has been Cambridgeshire Horizons.
Yep.
It's been operating for six years. And one kind of partnership, yeah, and it's a father, a mother, some kind of relationship to the LEP that's emerging with a different name.
Yes.
And you're going to talk a little bit about that as well as about Cambridge Horizons.
I will.
Growth and austerity in a world of localism, or one of those things.
Thank you. Okay, what I'll try and do, colleagues, is to talk through my slides for probably about half an hour and then open up for conversation. It's probably easier if you hold questions till we got to the end, unless there's an issue of just clarification as we go through. So I'm just going to talk a little bit briefly about Horizons, and then give quite a bit of context really around both the national position in relation to those issues of growth, localism, austerity, and how it looks from a Cambridgeshire perspective, which I think it's interesting looking at it in microcosm through an area like Cambridgeshire, given that it has so many of those elements of underlying economic potential, but the need for housing growth and infrastructure delivery. Talk a bit through the fact that the old model is very rapidly being dismantled, and is there a new model emerging? What is it? How can we make it work? Some thoughts around where home ownership is going to go in the future and what the position of private rent might be. A little bit about the impact of the localism bill and actually some of the social housing reforms, and then really concluding around those future funding models and some conclusions. So Cambridgeshire Horizons, being over 6 years, just over, was established by the local authorities of Cambridgeshire with the Regional Development Agency and what was then English Partnerships. It's a company limited by guarantee, doesn't have planning powers, but was basically set up to coordinate the development of the area with those five objectives that are there. It's actually been, I think, probably one of the most successful of the kind of local delivery vehicles that were set up as part of CLG's kind of growth areas programme. Probably the largest, I think the largest, and I suspect that the Cambridgeshire Growth Agenda is one of the most ambitious in the country in terms of the scale of new homes expected and the scale of the infrastructure challenges that go with that. But as part of the spending review, CLG cut all funding for all local delivery vehicles across the country with effect from April 2011, and so given that 95% of our funding was from central government, we were faced with a position where we just couldn't continue to operate. So I had to put to my board a couple of months back a proposition that says we're going to have to close because we can't operate without any meaningful means of support. And also because the local enterprise partnership is being set up. In addition to Chief Executive of Horizons, I'm also leading the work on trying to get our currently named Greater Cambridge, Greater Peterborough Local Enterprise Partnership going. And we must come up with a snappier name because I run out of breath before I get to the end of that sentence. And given that the Local Enterprise Partnership was one of the first to be given a green light by government, an announcement by BIS and CLG ministers last year, and that driving the local economic growth of Cambridgeshire means we still have to do all these things, my proposal was that we seek to use the Local Enterprise Partnership as the vehicle through which we now try and deliver the things that Horizons is doing, and what limited funds are around should be devoted to one place, and let's make the LEP work rather than having rival structures. So we will close in September. When I put that recommendation to my board, I was on the assumption that having kind of won the competition to be one of the green-lit LEPs, there might be some funding support available. How foolish. And part of the problem with LEPs, I'll come on to in a minute, is that currently they don't have any funding or capacity to do the kind of things that I think are being expected of them. But we'll touch on that later. So, just to give you a bit of the position on the national context, clearly the coalition's view coming into government was that the overriding concern was to get the deficit under control, to get the level of national debt down. And so the focus has been pretty much wholly on deficit reduction and on funding cuts. and no more apparent than in the Department of Communities and Local Government, where, I mean, I think really the Secretary of State essentially went and said, right, I'm gonna be the hardest guy in the Cabinet. I'm going to put my hand up and say, I can take the cuts, bring it on. 70% in funding reductions in capital, actually it was 74%, so, you know, I can take it. And when you look at the, and over, I think, 54% revenue reduction as well, when you look at the Communities and Local Governments programmes, that level of funding reduction is almost unrivalled. And it leaves the kind of infrastructure around housing growth support decimated. But underlying all of this, there's a standard assumption that future economic success still means we're going to have to get significant increase in new homes. All the areas of the UK that are likely to generate significant economic growth and significant private sector job growth, which is the coalition government's great hope to offset the loss of public sector jobs that are the result of the spending review, can only happen if we deliver significant numbers of new homes, hopefully, for the workers who will be working in those growing private sector businesses, and indeed the infrastructure, particularly transport, that's necessary to make that work. And herein, I think, lies the problem, because we have a huge shortfall of number of homes needed. We have done all the way through, really pretty much since the war. The number of homes needed against the number of homes available has got worse and worse year on year. It is, what the coalition say, well, it didn't work when we had top-down planning. Maybe it didn't. The numbers that are showing are getting worse at the moment because of the market. But actually, the issue which the opposition have focused on has been to say, you government have been driving down the cuts line, but where's your growth strategy? Where is it you can point to that demonstrates that you've got a viable growth strategy? And the reaction from government to what has mainly been an Ed Balls-led criticism has been quite interesting, because actually part of this dismantling of what was there and the lack of evidence of what may be coming in its place is a difficult place for the government at the moment. And looking at it from the Cambridgeshire context, it looks pretty difficult actually, because the things we've been relying on have gone, the new things aren't there yet. So I'll just give you a little bit of flavour of what's been happening in terms of building rates. So this shows you the collapse in the market in 2008, credit crunch, and the number of completions continue to fall. Slightly better news here as we start to see some starts coming back. There'll be a lag effect, but one hopes that completions will improve slightly as we come out of the worst of the credit crunch position. But even at this sort of peak level we reached at the height of the market, we're still way, way beneath what we need in terms of meeting housing needs, particularly in the acute need areas of the south and southeast and east. And home ownership is also going down, and this shows you, the red line there shows the level of people in mortgaged home ownership dropping since 1992 and more readily since 2005. Interestingly, the other line is on outright ownership, and you're seeing that slightly going up as people come out of mortgages. There's an interesting debate actually at a conference in Cambridge a couple of months ago, which Christine arranged, which talks about some of this story. And it's getting increasingly tough to get on the first rung of the ladder. This shows you the loan-to-value ratio for first-time buyers. And if you go back to 2006, it was averaging about 92%, rapid drop to about 84% in 2008, and it's been stuck at 75% since then. And I think this is actually a structural shift, not a cyclical change. I suspect that what we're seeing here is actually a change, which it may vary a little bit, but I don't think we'll be back at this sort of position for quite a long time. I think the appetite for risk in this market has reduced significantly. Remains to be seen, but it feels to me that this might be something that was with us for a long time. And this shows you what the deposit is as a percentage of income, an average in England between 2000 and 2009. And if you look back in 2001, it was about 16%, now it's 64%. Fourfold increase in 8 years, that's massive. And it basically changes the nature of the entry point into the housing market. And with interest rates likely to rise, this is going to become a more and more difficult position for first-time buyers. The local context, we had a discussion about this before we started. When you look at Cambridgeshire, and particularly the Cambridge sub-region, it's one of those parts of the country that really does have the right ingredients for quite rapid private sector growth over coming years. It has a kind of global brand recognition, which is very powerful, and not many parts of the UK can offer that. It has a really interesting set of interrelated clusters. So you'll know about the university, you'll know about the RMD within Cambridge. There's a very strong, Europe's biggest biotech cluster is all around the south of Cambridge and drawing down into Hertfordshire. There's the high-tech cluster based around the Science Park, which has been running for 50 years now. Increasing numbers of jobs in biomedical research, particularly in and around Addenbrookes. Quite a lot around advanced manufacturing and creative industries, and a growing clean tech cluster. And that's a kind of knowledge-based economic hub in and around Cambridge, which is probably unrivaled outside of London, has one of the best skilled workforces in the UK at graduate and postgraduate level, but does have some shortages in technical skills, levels 2 and 3. And it's trying to compete in a global market, because a lot of those industries, I suppose the other thing about those clusters is that there's an awful lot of export potential within those. And again, the government's putting its faith on export-led recovery. We probably have more of that in the Cambridge sub-region than many other places. But we're competing in that global marketplace for the best people. And winning that war for talent depends on us being able to offer quality of life, but housing and ability to get around. And I think we could argue, despite the dampness, a reasonable quality of life in Cambridge. But the housing market is squeezed at both ends. There's not enough affordable housing for people at the lower end of the market. It's actually not enough executive housing at the top end either. And the transport infrastructure, unless you want to go to London, is pretty woeful. So that's a real problem. So yes, the sub-region of Cambridge is one of the places that could be part of the UK's economic recovery, but we do need to create the right conditions for a flexible labour market, and at the moment that labour market is really quite tight. I've talked about some of this already, but we have a massive shortage of homes, particularly around affordable housing. There are real problems for low-wage workers in a place like Cambridge. You've got essentially potential for economic growth, but you need low-wage workers to feed that economic growth engine. But it's very hard for them to live anywhere near the places of employment. And unlike in London, where actually there's a more porous market in a sense, because there are actually public transport links that can take you in and out of London more readily, it's not easy to get to and from Cambridge. So if you live in the lower cost housing areas a long way away, you're facing an expensive and difficult, usually car-based journey to get to work, and then you have to pay an awful lot to park anywhere once you get to Cambridge. So there are real problems for low-wage workers, and my worry is that's about to worsen because of the social housing reforms. Because at the moment, a low-wage worker can still potentially get access to a housing association property at, say, 50%, 60% of market rent. As the new affordable rent programs come through and housing associations effectively can only offer 80% of market rent, my low-wage worker is faced with quite a difficult position, because can't buy, private rent's out of reach, housing associations' rents become out of reach when they get to 80%. What happens to them? And I think as we work through those changes, I think there's a risk of hollowing out of kind of higher cost cities, even though they may actually be the places that can generate some of that job growth. In Cambridgeshire, we don't have a problem with a kind of not in my backyard approach from local authorities. It's quite interesting when one contrasts the position in Cambridgeshire with other parts of the south, east and east. The local authorities in Cambridgeshire for quite a long time have actually swung in behind a spatial strategy that supports growth. So going back to the Cambridgeshire and Peterborough Structure Plan in 2003, where essentially local authorities said, we recognise we've got to deliver housing growth in order to continue economic prosperity. That spatial strategy says, yeah, we're up for growth. And the contract, if you like, was with government to say, yeah, we'll do that, but you help us on the infrastructure side. And that's part of why Horizons was set up and funded in the first place. If you look at somewhere like Oxfordshire, you have a very different sort of position, where the city have accepted the need for growth, Oxford City, but the surrounding areas have tended to be much more resistant to any such growth. So you create a position where the Oxford City Council is small, can't really grow much more within its boundaries and needs to grow out, but is faced with district councils who are naturally sort of very suspicious of what growth might mean. Whereas in the Cambridgeshire context, you've had a position where those fringe authorities have actually accepted the need for growth. And interestingly, when the Secretary of State announced the repealing of the original spatial strategy, wherein that original structure plan then sat, the leaders of the local authorities of Cambridgeshire put a statement together that said, notwithstanding the abolition of the regional spatial strategy, we still believe in our own plans for growth, because they were ours in the first place. So in a planning sense, we've got the right structure, I think. The difficulty is really around the implementation. And as I say, I think the plan is good. Just briefly, it's trying to link homes and jobs together. It's building on the existing public transport lines wherever possible, with one new line put in as a guided busway which runs from Cambridge to Huntingdon past the new town of Northstow. Plans for one new town, urban infill in Cambridge, fringe extensions to Cambridge, and then some growth in the market towns commensurate with their economic strength. But one of the problems we have is that the Department for Transport's announcement, the suspension of the planned upgrade of the A14, which was the biggest single transport project in the Highways Agency's programme, creates a real problem for major developments. So the new town of Northstow is right on the A14, predicated on that upgrade coming through. But with that not now happening, there are issues about how we resolve that problem, given the Highways Agency's concerns about the operation of that road as a major freight route from Felixstowe to the rest of the country. And in implementation terms, we're about to lose Cambridgeshire Horizons as a focal point for that growth. Not just Horizons as an entity, but also the funding support it used to bring in through mainly Housing Growth Fund capital. And I suppose I'd say that the local confidence in our ability to deliver the infrastructure to make the housing work has been the key to what's been a continued political support for growth and a reasonably strong degree of public acceptance of the need for that growth in Cambridgeshire. And if that contract starts to be broken, my fear is that then the reaction is back to a kind of NIMBY position. Just quickly, the local picture on building rates is a bit better than some of the national trends. So this shows you starts in the blue line underneath. There's a bit of sort of seasonal variation on that. But overall, actually not looking so bad, although a bit of a tail off here. And on completions, again, you know, declining, but not quite as bad as the national picture. But some of that has been because we were able to put some of our big capital programmes in to help major sites keep going through the period of recession. And our ability to use loan and equity funding to help some of the major fringe extensions is something that probably kept that picture more healthy than it would otherwise have been. This is a bit about the old model and new model, and the old model being dismantled. So if I think about growth areas and the way the government tried to set up the growth area programme, about focusing real attempt to drive a much higher rate of house building in areas that they felt could cope with that, the elements of it were these. So you had Housing Growth Fund, so you had unring-fenced capital budgets, and we've been used to running a 3-year programme in the sort of 40 to 50 million area, which meant we could do quite interesting things. We could build the Adam Brooks Access Road, for example, or give some of our money as a loan towards that, which opened up the whole of the southern fringe of Cambridge for development, otherwise couldn't have been done. It would have been very difficult to do it just off developer finance. We had low delivery vehicles in most of the growth areas. You also had support from regional development agencies who were seeking to support housing growth in those areas which had the potential for rapid economic growth, and a link into government offices as well. Actually, that was quite an important element. So there was a link. So it wasn't just a Whitehall-driven programme. You had a more local and regional element to it as well. And that backed by a regional spatial strategy which set targets and local plans had to be in compliance with it. This was the model. Along with that, you had quite major elements of social housing grant going into the major growth sites, and a kind of clear support and some cajoling, and some authorities may have felt that was over the top in terms of top-down control. The central government were clearly saying, yep, we're in this as well and we recognise our responsibilities. So in addition to this other funding, you also have things like direct Department for Transport funding going in to support growth areas. So the guided busway in Cambridgeshire directly funded through DFT, partly in recognition of the fact that Cambridgeshire had said yes to the housing growth. We also have joint planning arrangements which try and get us across the two-tier problems and also the district boundary problems, because a lot of our growth is partly in Cambridge, partly in South Cambridgeshire. So formalised joint planning arrangements, again supported by funding from local government to persuade local authorities to join up in that way. And a Homes and Communities Agency with a degree of funding which it was able to use quite flexibly to support some of these developments, and local authorities with some capacity. So that was the model, and there's an awful lot in all of that. And if you look at each element of those things, I'll come on to the last bullet in a minute, the joint planning arrangements may stay in place, but the support for them is going in terms of revenue support. Everything else has gone. The only thing that's in the old model, which I used to still argue about, was that growth areas, whilst they were generating future income for themselves by actually saying yes to economic growth, yes to housing growth, were not able to actually have any of the jam they were creating, because all of that was basically sort of sucked back into the treasury. So yeah, you create massive numbers of new jobs, new houses, but that money doesn't actually stay in the locality, it all goes back into treasury. So that was the old model. They're saying almost all of it gone. The new model, emerging new model, I think, probably has some of these elements in play, and I'll come back to this a little bit in the funding position. But there's the new homes bonus, which gives the sort of lower tier authorities, district councils, essentially additional funding for new homes they build. But not hypothecated to support growth. In two tier areas in particular, it leaves the county councils, who are the ones who have to deliver the infrastructure, unfunded, well, relatively unfunded, because the bulk of it goes to the district council. And it feels to me like a not particularly well-targeted bonus. I get the general kind of idea that it's good to actually reward those areas that say yes to growth, but as this stands, it feels like it may be a missed opportunity. Confirmation of the community infrastructure levy, yes, I think that's a good idea. It's better that we have that ability to use developer finance, developer contributions in a more coherent, consistent and dependable way. The announcements by the government of allowing tax increment finance to be used, although we still await the details, are again a step in the right direction. And essentially what that means is that the business rate income that you generate through investment in infrastructure, which hitherto has gone solely to the Treasury and been redistributed across the whole country, can now be held in that local area and used to fund the infrastructure that you put in place. So you use the future business rates that you create to repay the infrastructure that you put in place in the first part. So the announcements on that are positive. Suggestion from the government that business rates income could be relocalised would be the biggest single change in genuine localism that we've seen for many a long year. But we haven't seen it yet. So if it happens, that will really be a genuine underwriting of the principles of localism, because it actually gives back to areas the benefits that they generate through growth. It causes problems around equalisation and how you deal with that, but it does change the nature of the relationship between what a local community sees when it takes the pain on growth and what it may gain when that growth comes through. I think one of the things we've been piloting in Cambridgeshire is whether we could pool public sector assets across all the different bits of the public sector, so it's land and buildings, to then actually both reduce the size of that public sector estate and to actually benefit in some of the dividends from reducing that size. And that kind of pooling into like a public sector property company type approach is something I think we'll see more and more over time, because it's something you can do in a time when revenue is reducing, make the most of your assets. And we have quite a lot in Cambridgeshire, but they're all held separately, they're all run separately, and we don't make the most of the synergies that we could from putting those things together. There are other elements of future revenue streams like feed-in tariffs for renewable energy schemes, and there may be other innovative finance options like that that we can start to use. The Regional Growth Fund is there. It's about a third of what was available for the RDAs, and it's about three times the coverage, and it looks like it may be targeted more in the areas of the north and the Midlands that have the biggest difficulties in terms of coping with public sector job losses, although we'll see. And affordable rent, I talked about a little bit earlier. Affordable rent potentially gives housing associations more revenue without social housing grant, which allows them to invest, but it will probably only service a small element of the market, given it will be set at 80% of market rent. So there's an issue around all of that. And local enterprise partnerships. As I said, I've been leading the work on local enterprise partnerships, or our local enterprise partnership, and I think they potentially are fantastic, because it would give us the ability to align, perhaps for the first time, the efforts and energies of the private sector, the third sector, and local government towards an agreed set of priorities for any given area, and they're based on real economic geographies, or ours is anyway. Maybe some of them. Let's not mention Kent, Essex and Sussex. But it gives you an opportunity to really get that kind of shared endeavour around agreed set of priorities. The difficulty is that at the moment, for us at least, we're trying to do this with no capacity within the local enterprise partnerships. It's quite hard for business to fund them, per se. Local government are the only game in town, but of course, with the settlement that they're facing, it's very difficult for them to put money into this. And the government's decision not to pump prime them is what I think is a mistake, personally, because I think it would have been much better to have allowed them to get going and then set them a challenge of becoming self-financing within a couple of years, rather than trying to... It feels like we're trying to, I don't know, play a game of tennis against Roger Federer armed with a lollipop stick at the moment, and that's really difficult. But I think there's a problem with the elements of the new model, and what's common in all of that is most of this is about creating future revenue streams which are more under local control than they used to be, and moving away from a kind of grant-type model. Brief aside in some ways, but I just wonder whether one of the things we need to do in the country as a whole is to look at our private rental market and whether we could actually push private rent as part of our solution, and more of our solution than a focus on owner occupation. As I said earlier, I think the shift in mortgage availability may be a structural shift rather than a cyclical one. And you look at where we stand with the average age of buying a first home up to nearly 40 now. But the demand for somewhere to live is not dissipating. In fact, it's growing even further. And if social housing is becoming more difficult as well, it feels like there's going to be more of an express demand in the world of private rent. And that should, economically, one would expect, attract more institutional investment into the private rental sector. And we have far less of that in the UK than almost anywhere else in Europe. Christine's looking at me quite questioningly, but that was my understanding. You can tell me I'm wrong later. Part of the problem with private rent at the moment is it's generally perceived quite negatively. And again, in certain European countries, that's not the case. Rent is the norm, and it seems good, and it's positive, and people are quite comfortable about that. And if we move into a position where the churn in people's working lives is greater than it was 20 years ago, perhaps renting actually fits better, because owner occupation is quite a difficult thing. It's the cost of moving are very high. And so if we can get to a position where owner occupation is not the thing that everybody aspires to, but renting is okay, I think there are lots of positives in that for us as a nation as a whole. This is using Christine Whitehead's research from Cambridge Centre for Housing Planning Research. I think the interesting thing about this is just showing this kind of UK being quite an outlier with Ireland particularly. Very high levels of owner occupation at 70 in the UK, but also actually quite a low level of private rent, only 11, and that contrasts with, again, Ireland aside, much of the rest of Europe. And it just feels that has probably left us more exposed in some of the credit crunch position, and leaves our economic policy decisions so tied up with what's happening to house prices that potentially skews the broader picture on economic growth, or sustainable economic growth anyway. So localism, what does it mean for growth? The localism bill, to me, feels like it's got both elements in it. There are elements that are actually quite good, in terms of you can get to a position where if there's a development local people want, if actually that's positive, they feel good about it, then they can actually push that forward even if their council is not so positive towards it. But the whole neighbourhood planning sort of layer that's going to come into this, I think risks it becoming a much more piecemeal approach and much more complex, and the loss of the strategic planning layer, which was in the RSS before, is a real risk. So these are two comments, one from the RTPI and one from the Hygiene Group, which one can probably wrote. Sorry, you're smiling. Which talks about, in the first one, the lack of a coherent strategic planning system. And I'll come on to whether LEPs can be part of that, filling that gap. Combined with this complexity of the neighbourhood planning system, could actually go counter to what the government wants to achieve in terms of economic recovery. And then the Hybrid Group's point about it will definitely not encourage more affordable housing, because those local residents in more affluent areas will actually not include affordable housing because they fear will reduce their own house prices and the value of their own homes. And actually, the problem with this one is that these are the places you need the housing growth to come from, often. that this is your growth areas often. So where we are on funding, looking at some of the major schemes, particularly large schemes, viability is a real problem at the moment. That upfront investment is very difficult to get hold of. Transport is such a huge cost for a lot of the new developments, and because the general position from the Department for Transport, although they've had less of a hit to their funding, their capital funding, than many other parts of government, is still a big hit. The taxpayer funded schemes are going to be far fewer. The issues we're trying to deal with now around the A14 corridor are all about, can we get some mixture of private and public funding in? But it becomes much more difficult than it was. And there are big upfront costs for low carbon infrastructure, although that's much needed, and things like feed-in tariffs may help a little bit, but it's still all about upfront investment. How do we get there? Well, I think the answers must lie in this localism element in terms of funding. If we do actually genuinely devolve funding to local level and allow sensible borrowing against the growth premium, the growth dividends one creates, that gives you a chance to do things in the absence of grant. And if local authorities are able to really securitise those future revenue streams, business rates, ground rents, feed-in tariffs, whatever, this could actually give you a means of solving that front funding problem. But it's got to be accompanied by a reasonable degree of relaxation from the Treasury about debt, because at the moment the Treasury's mantra is anything that is debt must be stopped because we're too indebted. But actually there's good debt and there's bad debt, and some of this is good debt, and I think that's an issue about whether we can win an argument with the Treasury. But if you could get this to happen, I think it might change the psychology of growth, because at the moment local communities generally see the pain and not much of the gain. And this is part of trying to get a contract with local communities. You say, well, actually we keep the benefits of this, and that means we can deliver the infrastructure you need to make this growth both high quality but also to improve the quality of life for existing residents as well as new. As I said, excessive concern over public sector debt could stifle this. On the structures, if that's on the funding, on the structures, two-tier local government makes things difficult, and I'm still baffled by the fact that this government seems almost anti-unitary, which I don't understand. When, if you really wanted to drive costs down, one of the things one could obviously do would be to move to unitary government. It's beyond me, but anyway. What we need to do is align transport and planning. This is a particular problem in two-tier. And my view is that we should go for TfL-style models for all the major cities, and not just metropolitan areas. I think this is as important that we can have a transport for Cambridge or a transport for Reading as it would be that we have the passenger transport executive in Manchester or TfL in London. I think we need new systems for pooling both assets across administrative boundaries in the way I talked about earlier, but also revenues. And I think we're potentially making that harder with some of the things we're doing at the moment. The loss of the regional spatial strategy is, I think, a problem. Authorities could come together voluntarily to set out an integrated approach to growth and transport and planning and infrastructure, but will they? And I think the LEPs could be part of the answer to the vacuum left by the RSS abolition, and at least hold a development plan at the bigger level, at the sort of functional economic geography level, and help kind of overcome some of the risk that's not left by the loss of that, and indeed as a counterweight to the NIMBY elements of the localism bill. But because of the nature of LEPs as entities, and they will be business-led, I think that has to be in a kind of non-statutory way. It has to be something that holds a kind of economic vision and then sets out the spatial consequences. And it's something that's put together by LEPs, but ultimately it can only be a challenge function. It can't be a statutory function because they're not themselves democratically legitimate. But one would hope that local authorities playing an active role within LEPs would get to the right sort of answer on the kind of high-level spatial vision, and that then local plans would reflect what the view of the local enterprise partnership would be. But as I've said before, LEPs are currently neither empowered nor funded sufficiently to play that kind of role, or indeed other roles that I think government wants them to, in terms of driving economic development, innovation, policy, skills, and all these other things that were currently done by a very well-funded RDA and are expected to be somehow kind of coordinated through a non-funded LEP. So just to conclude, I think this rapid dismantling of all the existing structures and funding streams is a real risk to delivery, and my fear is that figure showing the number of housing completions dropping down and down may actually be something that continues on that route through for a while yet. I'm worried about the social housing reforms, particularly low-wage workers in high-cost areas, and what that might mean for putting a brake on economic growth, and indeed driving up carbon if basically everyone has to drive. The risk in the localism bill, the LEPs being insufficiently empowered to counter the NIMBY risk which is inherent within localism. Some thoughts on private rent, but the final point really is that I think if we're going to get anywhere on kind of delivering the growth agenda in the world we're now in, because there's no point in putting a hand out to Treasury and saying please give us grant, is that we need to get this revenue streams thing relocalised. And if government can deliver on that element, I think there's half a chance that local areas, and those local areas that are bold and have a deliverable plan and know what they're doing on sustainable development, could actually make some of this work, because they can do the borrowing themselves. And that's it.
Great, thank you very much. Right, can you put those conclusions up?
Yeah.
Give us some time to... Can I ask one question? It's a wonderful wide-ranging survey, and almost all the bits seem to fit together. The one I can't quite understand at the moment is the relationship between private renting and the peculiar problems of growth areas. Is there a particular link there?
Yeah, I think it's my link there is that let's just go down to the Cambridge sub-region at the moment. I think the Cambridge sub-region could generate quite a lot of new private sector jobs over the next 10, 15 years. But and a lot of those will be at the intermediate skill level. There'll be technicians working in some of the growth sectors in around Cambridge. But I don't think that they're not going to be buying houses, those people, because of the loan to value ratio issue and the cost of mortgages. And they're not going to be able to get into housing association properties either. So it's the private rent market that seems to be where they will emerge. But the private rent market is so constrained in Cambridge at the moment, there's not enough of it. So I wonder whether part of what we've been often talking about in the past has been driving up the numbers of owner-occupation homes and social housing. Whereas actually what I think perhaps we need to do is to ensure that growth agenda is also about driving up the quantity and quality of private rent as a better solution for some of those new workers. That's the link.
Just to pursue that a second, so the role you're thinking about for institutional finance, does that go beyond simply creating individual properties?
No, what I'd like to see is that you actually have more of a European-style rental product on offer, which is often bigger blocks, if you like, with dependable, reliable, nice accommodation with a landlord you can trust. There isn't some dodgy geezer who owns three properties and never comes around to fix the tap. It's that kind of model, and I think in city centres at least there's a chance that you could see pension funds and others moving into investment in that sort of rental product, which would be I think both attractive and remunerative for them.
And I'll just push in a bit further, are there more ambitious ways in which they can link into a growth agenda?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yes, completely.
That's where I thought.
And there are. And it's not just in that. That's one element. But yes, absolutely there are. Because I think part of drawing institutional investment in the end, going to be investment in some of the big scale infrastructure projects as well. And we've been pursuing with pension funds whether there's a way in which we can actually align their investment in some of our development, potential development gains, to broaden their property portfolio. Particularly close to home for some of them.
Very good. Right, questions? Martin
Simmons. One thing Martin you didn't mention, Alex.
Martin Simmons from where? Martin Simmons from.
Where are you from, Martin?
Well, I'll say the TCPA, actually.
Very good.
TCPA is currently very active in proposing amendments to the localism bill.
Yeah.
One thing you didn't mention that TCPA is currently taking up is the duty to cooperate.
Yeah.
In the bill.
Yeah.
And how clause 19, in fact, is very inadequate in the way in which it indicates that duty to cooperate could come about. But TCPA, together with some other organisations, has put forward an amendment, which was in fact tabled at the end of last week.
Mm-hmm.
You may know about it, which would, if accepted, give some very much greater clarity to the way in which interlocal authority of duty to cooperate could come about.
Hmm.
And because it's talking about local authorities, it gets away from the problem that LECs have being non-legal entities.
Well, they may be legal entities, but they're non-democratic.
They're non-democratic,
yeah.
But the status problem that they have, in fact, does mitigate against, it seems to me, some of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But if you pursued the duty to cooperate route and aligned that with the LEC geography,
yeah,
then it seems to me you'd be getting somewhere.
I think that would help, I agree, actually. If that amendment were accepted, it would help, because it would then bring some of that back into the democratic, because it's the democratic element rather than the legal entities. Because,
yeah.
I mean, I think we probably will end up with LEPs as legal entities, personally. I think that would help, because then gives you a more natural link back into local authorities sort of forced to work as a collective. And if it were mirrored with the LEP geography, that would be very helpful. One thing I wouldn't want to lose, though, is that the kind of business voice in all of this is really valuable. Because the business voice is saying, listen, guys, we've got to have a sensible development framework in place which recognises that you need new homes as part of the solution to economic growth. And that is a counterweight to what can often be a different view from local communities who are more nervous about development. But potentially, if those two came together, so you have a strong business voice kind of making the challenge function, but that effectively you had a stronger duty to cooperate, which kind of almost took you back to a structure plan type world, which is almost what you're suggesting. Fine.
Duncan Bowie, University of Westminster, was obviously the convener of the Hybrid Group on Deliberate.
So you're very pleased.
I think I'm just really following on from Martin's comment. I'm just wondering the basis of your optimism on LEPs. I mean, it may be that you actually
have thought I was optimistic.
Good working arrangements between agencies, but I mean, in the absence of funding, plus this issue of not actually having a statutory basis, does actually make them very limited, and that's created this nonsense that, as you say, some of the best agencies to collaborate aren't actually included in the provisions of the bill, as Martin mentioned.
Yeah.
But I'm main concerned about
the... Can you just find out what kind of agencies?
Sorry,
what kind of agencies?
Well, that LEPs are, or that LEPs...
No, that aren't included.
Well, LEPs is partly...
Well, I mean... LEPs are the key ones that aren't, but I mean, I was also going to come on to the broader infrastructure planning issue in terms of the relationship with other infrastructure providers, whether they're the utilities companies or, for that matter, the semi-privatised education and health systems. Because, I mean, even in a situation like Cambridgeshire, where you've got relatively low costs because of a lot of its greenfield, you've got relatively high values, you're still in a fundamental problem, as you expressed, about lack of infrastructure.
Yeah.
So I'm really interested, in a sense, in the absence of coordinated planning arrangements, despite obviously your joint planning team, which has a very valuable role, how you think the infrastructure planning is going to go in terms of the impact it actually has on your values.
Yeah.
And I'm interested about whether you actually think that the government may get into some kind of infrastructure taxation arrangement through these discussions that seem to be happening within DTI, so within BIS, I should say, about some possibility of land tax arrangements. Whether you think the equity stake agenda that some of us have been arguing for some years, which you mentioned, actually is an option the government may consider.
Yeah. You mean the Oliver Letwin work?
Yeah, okay.
The reason for my optimism about LEPs is almost that, despite everything, I think they've been set up in a way that makes it very hard for them to succeed, for the reasons you said. But actually, working with my local stakeholders, both politicians in local government and business leaders, is that there is this sense that there's a real desire to try to come together to solve the problems that are out with any one of their ability to solve, if you see what I mean. So it has unlocked a certain energy, which, despite all of the shortcomings of the LEP structures as currently stand, is why I feel a bit optimistic, although I'm still very concerned about the structures we're leaving us with.
Is that optimism peculiar to the Cambridge situation, to having strong expectations of growth and not strong NIMBYism?
not entirely. I think it also helps that there's a reasonably strong sense of collaborative working from the pre-existing structures. And I think there are other parts of the country where I talk to people and they're pretty upbeat. So if you talk to Manchester, they feel pretty good about their LEP because it's kind of an extension of what they've been doing in many ways, and they already have combined authority proposals and so forth. So there's more to go for that. I think it's harder for, I mean, we are a new partnership, but the core of it is an old partnership, so, you know, it's a bit easier. I think some are finding it really hard. So I think you get a mixed picture across the country. If you would take a confidence survey amongst those working on LEPs, you would get an interesting split, I suspect. On infrastructure planning, I mean, one of the things that Horizons has done a lot of, as you know, has been around infrastructure planning. And I think that's absolutely critical because it gives you a much greater sense of confidence about the ability to bring forward infrastructure and to then attract the investment needs to support it, both private and public. And one of the things I don't want to lose as Horizons closes is that infrastructure planning role, because I don't think maybe through the duty to cooperate thing it can somehow happen through the local authorities, but one of the things we've been able to do is we've brought our infrastructure planning stuff forward in Cambridgeshire through Horizons. It's been not just to kind of broker it through the six local authorities, it's also been to be able to talk to Anglian Water to actually align their capital investment programme with what's going on in terms of the growth. And in fact they found it very helpful because they've been able to, in their arguments with Ofwat, put their capital programme against the expected infrastructure needs set out in our integrated development programmes. So some of that I think has to live somewhere. It could live in local authorities, it could live in LEPs, but we must ensure we don't lose it. And on the final thing around kind of looking at whether there are different ways of infrastructure funding, I think they're going to struggle to get something away that looks anything like development land tax or PGS. Yeah. Because there's such a planning gain supplement, I do apologise, planning gain supplement, which was the proposals prior to the community infrastructure levy about looking differently at how one taxes development gain. I think that's going to be really, really difficult. I will have to wait and see. But it does feel like at the moment there's not really a very credible kind of national infrastructure investment plan. Although the Treasury did put out a document last year which tried to look at some elements of that, and actually as a document it was really good. It's whether they can see it through. Yeah, the follow through. I mean, it said things like, we will introduce a system of lorry charging. Why don't they do it? It'd be fantastic if you did that, because actually you would price off some unnecessary journeys and you'd get a whole bunch of hypothecated revenue which would allow you to deliver transport enhancements in the areas of most need. Why don't we just do it? Maybe paid by foreign freight as well, which is good for good for the Daily Mail reader.
I think in that's part of the story, isn't it? That we know that land taxation of almost any sort is a major crisis.
Yeah.
We know that planning gain supplement, which was 4 years' work, was put into planning gain supplement. It was given up overnight, literally. The civil servants were working on it on Friday night, and on Monday morning they got silk. They didn't know what silver was, nor did anybody else. And the reason, in part, for that was that they reckoned it was an 8-year process to get it working,
yeah.
By which time nobody would be paying it.
And they never solved the valuation problem.
And they never solved the valuation problem.
Yeah.
So the case for pricing rather than taxing seems to be really quite strong.
Yeah.
And you look at the A14, and I was talking very much without knowledge about how to, but no. The A14 ought to be fundable by something other than 100% government grant.
Yes.
And other than land taxation.
Absolutely right, because its main kind of cost is for freight transport that comes across from Felixstowe.
Yeah.
So in a classic sort of what's the right approach to taxation, well, you should tax those who impose the costs.
Yeah.
And those who impose the costs are basically heavy goods vehicles. Company don't pay anything like the full economic cost of use of it.
But equally, it should be possible for people to see an investment opportunity there.
Yeah, if the road starts to create a revenue stream.
Yeah.
Because at the moment, a road creates nothing. It's just a liability.
Michael Edwards, University College. Two questions. One is, could you expand a bit on what seems to me to be your most valuable, to me as most funny book, Papadism, you're making, which is about loosening up the mechanisms for bond financing. I've a bit ignorant about this in detail. I mean, what criteria do you now have to satisfy for borrowing not to be counted as part of public sector borrowing? That's the question.
Okay.
The other question is, all this stuff around Cambridge sounds great, but it's a bit small compared with the need. Could you comment, in a personal capacity, I'm sure, on the proposal to have a great big link up between Cambridge, Milton Keynes and Oxford?
Yeah, sure. Okay. On the first one, the first bit of the question was, what do you have to do to make it count not on balance sheet? It's almost impossible for it not to be on balance sheet unless it is not actually underwritten by any public body. It almost has to be fully privately funded in order for it not to count against the public sector. No risk underwritten by anybody. So the problem with all of, and I'll come on to how they work in a minute, the problem with all this stuff is that if I manage to, let's say the government relocalises business rates, hooray, and then I go and raise a bond, for example, on the back of my future business rates, and I'm Cambridgeshire County Council in this context, yeah? If there's a massive economic disaster and Cambridge, you know, everybody leaves Cambridge and moves to Oxford because it's a much better place to do business, and my business rate income that I was expecting just does not come through, it's highly unlikely, but let's say this happened.
Or change of government.
Or a change of government, that might be slightly different. But anyway, let's just say the business rate income doesn't come through. Then, if I default on my bond repayments, the Treasury stands behind me in the end, as the Treasury stands behind every public sector body in the end. So the reason it counts, I'm not a kind of an accountant, but my understanding of the way the International Accounting Standards Boards work is that you have to count that on the ledger for public sector debt. I think that's right. But it's my understanding. So attempts to get it off balance sheet, I think, are not worthwhile. So I think you have to say, okay, it is on balance sheet, but in something like the position I've just given you, there are about 17 layers of obscurity that have to be burnt through before it actually ever got to the Treasury having to stump up and bail out Cambridgeshire County Council. It just isn't going to happen. It's not. It's a negligible risk. So, okay, it counts, but Treasury shouldn't worry about it, particularly if you're going to see it investing in things that will deliver you growth. So you should be okay. Just quickly on how it would work, would be in the simplest possible way, if you start to create a position where the value that derives from development is available to the local body, whoever that might be, then it is feasible for that local body to borrow against those future revenue streams. But that's it. It's no more complicated than that. But at the moment, we don't have any of those revenue streams available to us because they are all centralised. Unless you own the land. And the standard, you know, in terms of the tax elements, the benefits of it, they don't come to you at the moment. They go into the Treasury pot. So that's why you can't do it, but could in the future. The simplest way to do it is just to borrow from the Public Works Loans Board. That's simpler than doing a bond. You don't have to do bonds, it's just a different way of raising the debt. Second question, should we join up Oxford, Milton Keynes and Cambridge? Yeah, be great. The problem you got is that the work on looking at the Oxford to Cambridge arc has largely been about, can you connect a rail route through? And you can get from Oxford to Bedford, and great, let's do that. You can't get from Bedford to Cambridge because when Beeching cut that line, it got built over, and so it's impossible to do that line. So the only way you can then get from the last bit from Bedford to Cambridge is to go down to Hitchin and back up again, or up north to Peterborough and down again, which takes the benefit out. So my view on the Oxford-Cambridge arc bit is do what you can. Do the western bit. Get from Oxford to Milton Keynes and through to Bedford. Maybe we could then do a rapid bus transit thing to do the last link, but you can't do it with rail. Well, not unless you want to spend billions, which is just not available. So yes, we should do it, and yes, we should look at how we. I mean, to my mind, there's a sort of bigger issue for the UK, which is where we're really playing in global markets and where we have a real cutting edge still is probably in a kind of golden triangle, which is sort of Cambridge, Oxford, London. Let's make the most of that not necessarily in transport terms, but just to sell the excellence we have in some of our science base and some of our kind of spin out companies in that area. And we don't do enough of that, which we can do.
Yes, the new homes bonus.
Yeah.
Who are you, Ben?
Researcher.
A researcher.
Whatever.
Yes.
I just, you know, the new homes bonus is being comforted as being the great incentive for areas to build. But could it actually be used as a serious funding source? You know, there you've got a commitment theoretically about 6 years.
Yep.
Yep. Could it do.
And you could borrow against it. I mean, the thing about new homes bonus is that it's probably dead weight, because I don't think many people are going to change what they were going to do because of it. So I think it's probably kind of rewarding things that would have happened anyway, but that might be all right, possibly. Because it's been split the way it's been split, with the majority in two-tier land particularly, with the majority going to the district council, not to the county council, it makes it a bit harder to be used as an infrastructure funding tool, given that the infrastructure authority is either the county council or bits of government, whereas the kind of recipient is the district council. And the risk is that as they're all facing massive funding cuts, they use the new homes bonus to plug their gap in their bin emptying kind of budget. So it goes to help empty the bins, which might be good if you live in that council and you're worrying about your bins being empty, but doesn't solve the infrastructure funding problem. So the fact that it's not been, it's mostly goes to the district council and you can do what you want with it. If they'd ring-fenced it to support growth, then I'd be more optimistic. Now, maybe you can win an argument with the district councils that says, well, actually, what you should do with this stuff is make it available for infrastructure, and then we can borrow against it. That would be good, wouldn't it? But I fear that may not be how the politics plays out. So I'm a bit... Yeah, I did list it as part of what I think you could use, but it's very tempting. I mean, if you put yourself in the position of a councillor facing the worst settlement you've ever had, and you're looking at how you make the books balance, it must be very tempting to use that future new homes bonus revenues to spend on meeting the shortfalls in whichever bit of your budget that you may be worried about most. And if you can't afford to enter the bins, that's probably the first thing you do, because that gets you voted out if you haven't voted into them. Especially if Eric Pickles wins, is everybody has to do a weekly bloody collection.
You only get the bonus if you get the housing. And if you can't get the housing, if you've got the infrastructure. So you could actually see it in the way of facilitating more new bonus.
If you have an absolute need to kind of deliver some infrastructure to break outside, it's that kind of thing. I think it slightly changes it. But if you could kind of get away with delivering some housing without really doing the infrastructure you need, then that's a bit of a problem. The other thing is that, I mean, the big cost is kind of schools. And it's not going to help much in terms of funding new schools. Well, I mean, again, it could, but the traditional position in two-tier land is the district says, well, that's the county's problem. And the county's sat there becoming more and more impoverished. So I wouldn't dismiss it, and I think we all ought to look at ways in which we can use it in exactly the way you just described, Ben. But the way it's been set up makes it harder for it to be used in the most sensible way than if it had been set up in a different, slightly more constrained fashion.
The spatial structure of these incentives, as far as I'm concerned, for housing, the point is to try and remove the disincentive for local areas within a functional economic area.
Yeah.
To do things which block growth for that area from which all will benefit.
Yeah.
On the commercial side, it seems to me that what you're being offered is a positive incentive rather than a disincentive. So you get the business rate.
Yeah. Which is, yeah.
Without the same economic logic to it. And it seems to me it's quite likely to incentivize actually the chasing of marginal projects which could have been located anywhere inside that functional urban region. Is that unreasonable? Because I don't think that there's a great resistance at present to taking on commercial projects. as there is to taking on housing.
No.
But there might become a chase for the supermarket. So the easiest way of getting revenue is not going to be allowing some piece of foreign direct investment to come in, which benefits the whole of the region, but it's going to be something we should pinch for your neighbours, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess there is a risk of that, because obviously, you know, in a business rate world, then, you know, there's a straight economic benefit to delivering additional jobs, however that comes, in a sense. And it goes back to why it's really important there's still a spatial strategy, actually. I mean, in the end, because that would be the normal thing that would sort of, you know, kind of hold off kind of opportunistic development in a way that perhaps had other negatives around it and didn't keep the jobs and homes in balance point, or encourage, you know, unsustainable travel patterns and that sort of thing. So I think there is a risk of that. I mean, interestingly, TIF doesn't do that, because TIF ties the business rates one gets directly to the infrastructure one puts in. So that is not, in that sense, opportunistic.
But it has the same problem that you had before, that the infrastructure wouldn't be provided at the level which got the incentive.
No, I think a TIF it would do that, actually, because I think, I mean, essentially, as long as you've got a business case that stacks up, if building the tram does genuinely massively increase the numbers of businesses or the value of existing businesses in that area, then actually, if it's enough to pay for the cost of the tram, then you should do it. So I think it's all right in that context. I think the risk you put up is probably in the world where business rates just get fully relocalised, and there could be then a temptation for some...
Relocalised rather than relocalised.
Well, they were localised before.
I think for the majority of authorities, they've never got the benefit of business rates.
I think if you go back to the 13th century when business rates were first created, I think they were localised.
Might have done. Not in my life.
Wasn't it, sorry, on that historical point, I mean... Wasn't it the decision of the Thatcher government?
I thought so, yeah.
When they created uniform business rate and poll tax.
Yes.
But the uniform business rate would be 80%.
But previous to that, because of the equalisation mechanism.
Ah, because of the equalisation scheme.
Then 80-odd% of authorities got no benefit. And when Thatcher changed it, almost 100% got no benefit.
The point was, you could still have used it as a thing against which to borrow, even in a loser scenario, which you can't do anymore.
Christine, coming back to the new homes bonus, I mean, you've got three groups, haven't you? You've got you and Ben, who wants to build infrastructure more generally. You've got the councillors who want to fill gaps in their money.
Yep.
But you've also got what, if you're in a housing group, you regard it as an important thing, but you've got some money to help that set of consumers. Not a general set of consumers, but that set who are suffering directly from it.
From a lack of housing?
From the fact that something's being built next door.
Oh, I see, from the immediate impacted neighbourhoods, yeah.
So there are three distinct groups you're trying to fight to. It's rather small part of one of these stuff.
Yeah, although SIL is also available.
That's where I wanted to come to. Where is SIL fitting into this? Given
Where we got to with SIL was that what
SIL is the
community infrastructure levy. So this is,
and the neighbourhood requirements are
under the local.
Yeah,
we don't know.
Prior to the neighbourhood planning element of this, where we had got to with our proposals for a community infrastructure levy in Cambridgeshire was that we had agreement from all six local authorities that they should actually collaborate on this and treat it as a common kind of funding source and then agree between them how to make it work. Now, of course, you would set your charging schedule dependent upon really what the market could bear. I mean, because we have the underpinning in Cambridgeshire, we have the underpinning evidence around our infrastructure plans, we can justify on that basis a community infrastructure levy of £60,000 a house. On that assessment. So what it comes down to is what can the market bear? Because obviously, if you charge 60k, you don't get any development at all. So you actually base your level at which you set the levy upon what the market can bear, and that will vary from place to place. What you spend it on is actually kind of something I think you don't need to specify so much in the charging schedule, in a sense. I mean, a high-level explanation of the kind of things you're going to deal with. But once you've got it rolling in, the logic then is you have a sensible arrangement between the local authorities, particularly between the tiers, which allows you to pool and to spend on priorities. But you've got enough to allow you to have an element there that nods to the neighbourhood level. So that says, actually, OK, if you're in this part of St Neots and you've got the major development on your doorstep, what are the key things that you need to make that acceptable for the existing residents? And actually, those things are often quite small community-level interventions. So if it's a new children's playground, you just include that in what you then spend through. I think the key thing is that you have something that does actually hold together around the relevant geography again. And I suppose it's back to that duty to collaborate. If that applies to SIL in the same way as it could apply elsewhere, that would strengthen what we were trying to do anyway. And I think the neighbourhood element of it is entirely soluble within that. I'm not actually that worried about it. It's an issue for the district council to deal with, but it's fine. You know, I think that's perfectly all right, isn't it? Why shouldn't the neighbouring community, you know, have some element of recompense for the fact that they're dealing with a major development nearby, which may put greater pressure on the existing local services? Seems a perfectly reasonable deal to me. Everyone's silent. So
can I ask, what duty to cooperate?
Yeah.
What does that mean in practice? What's the force?
Well, it's my best question at the beginning, yeah.
I don't want to cooperate. What happens to me?
Yeah, it's difficult to know how it'd be policed, isn't it? I suppose somebody could presumably take you to court for failing to demonstrate that you had lived up to your requirements to cooperate as set out in the bill, which could be a developer. So I suppose it may be policed. Is that feasible? I mean, it's not entirely clear.
What we've been seeking to get into the bill is some definition of what it actually means in terms of the kinds of issues upon which groupings of local authorities should cooperate. I mean, housing requirements is obviously one. There's matters to do with the climate change agenda. There's the transport and other infrastructure. There's a relationship with economic development, which is where the LEPs link up, I think, comes in. So it's about sort of clarifying the kinds of matters upon which local authorities need to get together.
But it would be an interesting point, wouldn't it? Because if, let me tell my Oxfordshire example again. Oxford City Council is saying, we absolutely have to grow, it's critical for the future economic development of this area. But if West Oxfordshire says we don't agree, our view is that we need to build no houses. Who is to cooperate with whom?
The Prime Minister is hardly likely to support Oxford against his own city.
Exactly. So what? But my point. Maybe I should use two others. But the point is, they may not be cooperating, but it's a political choice, isn't it? So it's quite hard to see how it kind of works. If you've got a degree of kind of commonality of purpose, but if you have an absolute opposing view, who wins?
It seems to me there's ambiguity about cooperating is about procedures, so getting together.
Yes, you
cooperating is actually delivering action, yeah, which is not what you'd have chosen to do otherwise.
So if you're even having discussions with civil servants about whether answering an email is sufficient to demonstrate collaboration, that level,
cooperation.
I mean, it's highly unlikely the government's going to prescribe this, and ministers have basically implied that if, you know, that Norfolk can deal with climate change on its own, it doesn't need to cooperate with anybody else.
Yeah.
Even after it's all flooded.
Unless it's exactly on this then, isn't it? So he's got a question queued up. Is it exactly on this?
It was exactly on this.
Right, then go.
I think here it's very useful to listen to Martin Simmons, because for a lot of his career he was running the London Planning Advisory Committee, which was a rather ad hoc organisation set up to fight. And he somehow made it seem. Well, it was set up with very modest expectations all around, and I think nobody thought it would do very much. But it was rather a lot. So it might be helpful to.
Well, I think you should come and run a LEP then, Martin.
Can we talk about nice houses for a change?
Please do, yeah.
What struck strikes me about the Cambridge housing market is the extraordinary shortage of nice houses. There's plenty of rubbish houses. You can go almost anywhere in the Cambridge area. Acres of cheap, miserable, small.
Are you particularly using Cambridge here, or is this true generally?
No. The Cambridge house.
Oh, fine. Okay.
I think Cambridge itself, you know, the old houses in the private sector are generally very small. The big houses have all been bought by the university.
Yeah.
So there's a bit round Grange Road, maybe, but not much. The unique thing about Cambridge at the moment in the UK is that it has is the one place where there is genuine scope for massive economic growth. On the back of the technology centres that are clustering in the area.
Absolutely right, yeah.
In 30 or 40 years' time, even if we were to get the infrastructure and all the rest of it, which we probably not, how are we going to attract the technology professionals from California and Switzerland, Amsterdam and Paris and places where, trust me, the standard of housing is immensely high.
I agree. I think I said in my opening comments that actually it's about housing at both ends of the market. It's about the executive housing as well as being about the social housing. And in fact, you need both. And part of what the growth agenda in general is attempting to do, and in fact, there are examples of developments even more recently, which are more in that kind of model. They're not like the big piles, because that kind of tends to happen sort of almost out with. But when you look at something like the Accordia development on Brooklands Avenue, which won the Stirling Prize, the Accordia it's a high-end development. It has elements of social housing in it, but actually there's some properties in there which probably would be attractive to the university professor coming over from Freiburg, shall we say, to use an example. And so it is part of that. And the southern fringe developments, the south of Cambridge, where there'll be 4,000 homes dotted in and around the expansion of Addenbrooke's hospital, they will have significant large-scale executive housing as part of the mix. As the northwest Cambridge development happens to the west of the city, largely university-led development, yes, there'll be some specific postgraduate kind of accommodation in there. Yes, but there'll also be sizable private market housing at top end, and it will be Grange Road style for those who know Cambridge. So it is part of that. And in fact, the strategic housing market assessment is really interesting in that it shows that there's a gap at almost every layer of the market from the top end, and that matters because you want to attract the best kind of professionals to come and work here, almost all the way through. And so the plan is not just to build more Romseys, you know, with kind of smaller units. It's actually about having a mix of that housing coming through. And the top end of the market is important as well as the social housing. So I agree, and it is in there. In a sense, some of that looks after itself, because if the developers are allowed to do some of those sorts of top end housing and believe they can get top dollar for it, they will want to build them. So we don't specify that as much, but it will come through. Particularly in those, the reason for the fringe extensions of Cambridge is partly that it provides the sort of housing for those people close to the city, rather than them having to go out into the villages.
I'm kind of confused, because I don't understand what is meant by locals, and that's what we've learned something about here. I'm even more confused, because I cannot see that localism, which means self-reliance and all that stuff, from the bottom up and the lowest can decide and all this kind of stuff. And then you're advocating that basically those two tiers of local government are really a bit in a way, so they're lumping together so that it's easier to deal with them and all that. And the other bit is also self-reliance is okay, but all of this thing, they have to find their own money, we heard today on the radio. Never mind, big society is just you and doing your own thing. And then why shouldn't the LEPs and the business participate on LEPs, not also, especially as it's around the land of the democratic setup, put their own money into that and their own risk and so on? Why always go and stretch the hand out to the public sector, you know, if they want to do it privately? So why shouldn't, why don't they do it business-like themselves?
Okay. Let me take the first point first. The reason I think the unitary authority is a better way of doing things is that it allows you to align the powers around planning and transport, which if they're not put together, you can't do development. to my mind, unitary authorities give you a better way of delivering localism, because actually at the unitary authority level you can actually do things in a way that expresses the will of the locality better than in a two-tier environment where you have two different administrations that don't necessarily speak to each other. So I think localism is better expressed if you have a unitary government style.
Localism was a majority, I suppose. That for me is not localism.
But it would still be, I mean, if you, in a unitary authority scenario, the majority would be elected by the democratic will of the electorate. They're just voting for one.
If you have local authorities, you just have a central government, then it's even easier.
No, because I think in a unitary government position, you actually allow there to be decisions made at a geography in the sense that, that actually makes sense to local people. So
For what issue?
Any issue, actually. Why is two-tier more localist than unitary?
Well, I don't think for where I live, right? I have a unitary authority for Reading. Just down the road, I have another unitary authority for Wokingham.
Hmm.
These make some kind of sense in terms of the different kinds of environments and politics of places. They make no sense in relation to transport. They make no sense in relation to what the other issues you want to talk about here.
Hmm.
It seems that there can't be one geography which makes sense for all of the issues.
No, there can't. But two-tier always makes it worse, is my contention. Mm. And you're better off with working with two unitaries, which could then come together on transport, because that made sense. Because you should base transport decisions on travel to work areas. Surely. Two-tier just creates an artificial barrier. And it's confusing to the local electorate. They don't know who's responsible for planning and transport. They don't know why they're voting once for a district council and once for a county council a lot of the time. So, to my mind, I don't think unitaries are anti-localist, personally. But I mean, it's a, you can have a different
I suspect the problem with localism is that nobody will know who's doing anything at all anyhow.
Well, possibly. The second point on LEPs, though, the point on LEPs is a really important one. LEPs are about generating a general economic benefit. That's what they're for. They're about trying to create a scenario where the general economic well-being of any given area is better than it would otherwise be. They're not about delivering private benefit for a particular private company. So the difficulty that private industry has is that it's quite hard, unless they did it as a kind of corporate social responsibility payment, it's quite hard, if I've got a duty to my shareholders to maximise profits, it's quite hard for me to put some money into a LEP. If I'm a widget manufacturer in Ely, I've got to justify to my shareholders that putting money into a LEP is going to drive my profit base. The other thing is, I might take that view, possibly, but if my rival widget manufacturer in Cambridge didn't take that view and didn't put money into the LEP, and the LEP then did something that benefited my Ely LEP, widget manufacturer, then I think the LEP gets taken to court on that basis. So it's because you're not allowed to favour one ahead of another. So it's quite difficult to find a private sector funding model for individual businesses, at least. I think it could be possible for representative bodies of businesses to put some money in. The difficulty they've got at the moment is the LEPs are unproven, and it's not clear what you get back. So that at the moment, what seems to be likely, and we've tried to look at a funding model which included business funding, very, very, I think all of the LEPs have so far got support, but they just can't see how that works. And the input is likely to come from business will be time and people, not cash at the moment.
I think we must stop. This clock is 3 minutes slow. Okay. Thank you very much. You've been really stimulating.
Thank you. Thank you for your questions.